We're doing Parashat Yitro. We'll do a quick overview before we begin. We're told that Yisro hears the miracles that happen, so he takes Moshe's wife and children, and he brings them to Moshe. Moshe goes out to greet him. He tells him all the great miracles Hashem did for them. Yisro's happy. He blesses Hashem. He brings the sacrifice. And the next morning, Moshe sits to judge the people. Yisro says, why are you doing this? Such a long line. You're going to wear out. Listen here, ask Hashem, but if you set up judges, it might be better off. And so he asks Hashem, and Hashem approves. So he sets up judges. We're up to Ravi. And we've come to the Sinai Desert. And we camp in united form. This is the first time that we're actually united. The only time that we're actually united. And Hashem tells him, go tell the Jews, you've seen what I've done. I've brought you here. If you keep my covenant, you will be my nation of priests. Here's what I want you to do. And Hashem says, I want them to prepare for three. The nation says, we will do whatever Hashem says. And Hashem says, fine, if you're willing to do as I say, so I'm going to come, and the nation will have a clear revelation. They prepare for 3 days. No one touches the mountain. And Hashem appears. There's great noise. There's great fire. There's a trumpet, a shofar blowing. And Hashem descends on Mount Sinai. And Hashem gives us the Ten Commandments. Okay, so what are the Ten Commandments? Let's go. What's the first one? I am Hashem who took you out of Egypt. Number two? Shouldn't believe in any other force. Number three? Okay, no making of any figurine. No bowing to them, no serving them. Number four? Don't swear in Hashem's name in vain. Number five. Zachar Yom Shabbos LeKadesho. Number six. Honor your parents. Number seven. Lo Tirtzach. Don't murder. Lo Tinaf. Lo Tignov. Don't give false testimony. And don't covet. Don't desire. So we got to 11. So it's a little tricky counting 10, right? We just got to 11. So how do we know there are 10? Maybe there are 11 commandments. Where does it say there are 10? So at the end of the Torah says, Aseret Advarim, the 10 things I told you. So that's what Nachmanides points out. That's a little complicated knowing how to divide it into 10. Okay. The nation tells Moshe, we're scared we're going to die. We want you to tell us. And Moshe says, yeah, but you had to encounter this. You had to go through this because that'll give you strength to stand up to all of life's tests. You'll know. We saw prophecy. Hashem concludes the parsha with the commandment that our altar should be made of earth. And when we ascend to the altar, if we're going to make an altar of stone, you can't use a sword on it. You can't use metal. And the ascent to the altar has to be a ramp, not steps, because they used to wear robes and stuff, so their robes were pretty short, and if they'd go up steps, so their private parts would be revealed. So you gotta... Right, yeah. Okay, so now we're going to review our parsha. Who is Yisro? So Yisro is our first ger, right? All of the Jewish people are accepting the Torah, and Yisro wants to come and join. Yisro lives right near Amalek, and when everyone hears about the great miracles of what Hashem did for Am Yisrael, so Amalek says, let me attack. Hashem's appearing in the world. And Yitro says, let me join. Hashem's appearing in the world. Whenever we see someone who's greater than us, someone who's impressive, someone who's doing something good, so there are two natural reactions. One natural reaction is, let me get a part of that. And one natural reaction is, let me find what's wrong with that. Let me find a way to detract from that. because we feel threatened by someone who's better than us, who's greater than us. So Amalek is the epitome of that. They actually attack us. What did we do to them? We didn't do anything wrong. We were just Hashem's chosen people. Let's attack them. And Yisro is the epitome of standing by those who are good. He joins. He helps. He says, let me be a part of it. So how many names does Yisro have? Okay, you know the names? Reuel, Geter, Yitro. Chovav, Hever, Keni, Putiel. Yeah. So, he's taking along Tzipora. Tzipora is called Isha Kushit, a woman who is exceptionally pious, just like someone who is black stands out among white people, so too Tzipora would stand out among people for her piety. And the Pasuk says, Achar Shiluchah, after Moshe send her. Two opinions, did Moshe divorce her or not? Tzipora is going to come back, and Moshe will never again be intimate with her, because when Hashem appeared to Moshe at the burning bush, Hashem told him, take off your shoes. What does take off your shoes mean? That's a modest way to say separate from your wife.
Okay.
No. Shal na'alecha me'al raglecha. Take off the covering off your feet. So very often in Tanakh, the word foot is a euphemism for the male organ. And take off the covering as a way of saying separate from your wife. So Moshe Rabbeinu, even though Tzipora will seem to be his wife externally, but in the tent, they sleep on two sides of the room. She's coming with her two sons, yes.
Is that why Miriam was punished so greatly for criticizing this, because Hashem commanded him to?
Correct. 100% right. That's what Chazal say, that when Miriam spoke badly about Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem said, I told him to separate from his wife. What do you think? He did it on his own? He was modest. He never told anyone, but Hashem told him to do it. Yeah. So Yisro comes and he sees all these clouds surrounding the people in the desert. How do you enter? Can't figure out a way to enter. So he takes an arrow and he wraps around the arrow a letter saying, Moshe, I'm out here. I'm coming. Shoots an arrow. The letter is brought to Moshe, and Moshe goes out to greet him. Now, whenever we meet with someone else, we have a certain internal fear. This even happens when you're dating someone. So between two dates, we go down a notch in our relationship, and when you come to the next date, you wait to see, are they happy to see me, or are they not happy to see me? Anytime we meet someone where we have a certain inner inhibition, where we wonder, is that person happy to see me or not? Even the teller who you're never going to see again at the bank, or the checkout clerk who you might not see again at the store, if they smile at you, you feel good. And if they frown at you, you don't say they must be having a bad day. The feeling you right away have is, why are they upset at me? What did I do wrong? That's the way we view the world. And even though logically we can say it has nothing to do with me, at the end of the day, that is the way we view the world. So we have a Mishnah that tells us, when you meet someone, smile, show some teeth. Uleven shinayim mechalav. Shammai says, greet everyone warmly. Moshe is going to re-meet his father-in-law. He's going to re-meet his wife and his children. He goes out to greet them. When your kala comes to the chuppah, you go out to greet her. You take a few steps out of the chuppah. Even the people at the chuppah should take a few steps to greet the kala. There's always that fear. Does he really want to marry me? The 7 days you have before the wedding where you don't talk to your kala, you should send a little gift every day. A little gift with a little note. You tell her how you're waiting. Yes, we all have this feeling. Does the person really want to see me? I know people that when they have a guest coming to them for a meal on Shabbos, they leave the front door open till the guest comes. Because there's always that uncomfortable feeling standing and knocking on the door. Are they really happy that I'm coming, or am I really being a nuisance? So if the door's open and they see him from afar and the kids go out to greet him, so they give him a feeling, we're happy to see you. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was a pretty busy person, right? He was the one who was in charge of Jewish education after the Holocaust in the United States. Most major educational questions came to him. And when he would have a guest, he would walk him all the way down and stand there and wave as the car went away. How many times do we walk a guest, but then we turn our backs the second they go into the car? He would stand and wave. That extra few seconds gives the person a feeling, I'm happy you're here. And Chazal wanted us to have that sensitivity. Levaya, accompanying a guest when they leave, is part of the mitzvah of achnasat orchim. Let the guest leave feeling like you're happy they came. Not like, a tree. I couldn't wait till the guy left. Very nice. So Moshe goes out to greet his father-in-law. Moshe goes out to greet his father-in-law and wife and children. And when Moshe goes, so Aaron goes. And when Moshe and Aaron go, so their kids go. When they go, the elders go. And if the elders go, then everyone tags along. So you have this big entourage coming out to greet Yisro. Now, when Moshe was younger, so Moshe would say, I am Yisro's son-in-law. And now Yisro was going around saying, I am Moshe's father-in-law. So you should all have that aspiration that your fathers-in-law should be able to say, I am so-and-so's father-in-law. You should make a name for yourself in the world, a good name for yourself. So Yisro hears about all the things that Hashem did on behalf of Moshe and the Jewish people. And the word that the Torah uses is Vayichad Yitro. Now the word Vayichad has two meanings. In Aramaic, the word Chadi means to be happy. So we all understand that to mean Yisro was happy. But in Hebrew, the word vayichad literally means to become, to have goosebumps, to have folds. So Yisro started having goosebumps because he hears about how the Egyptians drowned. So here our sages say, even if a person's a 10th generation from Arameans, don't speak badly about Arameans in front of him. We once had a student here who was a very sincere convert, but he was Greek. And whenever there were soccer games and people were rooting for the Israeli team, he couldn't stand it. He'd walk out of the room. Because he said, those are my players. He came from Greece. And when there were games, Greece versus Israel, he'd feel very bad that people were like booing the Greeks. Now, that's normal. Our sages say that's normal for generations later. We have to have that sensitivity that a person's going to feel loyalty. Look at me. I didn't convert, but I didn't have the merit to convert. But I come from the United States, and I can tell you that I see a lot of positive in the United States. And I feel bad when people speak badly about the United States because I see a lot of positive. I'm saddened by the things that I think are wrong there. But there's a certain loyalty that I have to the place I grew up in. So Chazal say it's even more so when a person has converted from a people, so then there's a loyalty he feels. And that's why Yisro, on the one hand, he's very happy for the Jewish people. On the other hand, he has goosebumps. He's not comfortable hearing how the Egyptians suffered and they drowned. And he blesses Hashem. He says it's unique what Hashem has done here, because ordinarily, when he studied all the other pagan religions, so they were always looking to say, you know, because I did this, that happened. Everyone tries to claim that. But in what Hashem did, Hashem showed how the punishment fit the crime. The way Hashem works with the world is midah keneged midah. There's a likening between the crime and the punishment. Yisro was there when the Egyptians plotted to throw the Jews into the Nile, right? Yisro was there when they were talking about when they were deciding to throw the Jewish babies into the Nile. So now he hears how the end of the Egyptians was. They all drowned in the Yamsuf. They all drowned in water. So Yisro says there's an obvious correlation here.
Yitro is Egyptian, right?
Yitro came from Egypt. Yes, he was one of Pharaoh's advisors. So Yitro teaches us something. He brings a sacrifice of thanks to Hashem. Midian is a nomadic tribe that is east of Israel. Midian is one of the children of Avram Avinu. One of Avram's children from Keturah was Midian, and he developed into a nomadic tribe. That's why I didn't say he was Egyptian. I said he was an advisor to Pharaoh. Moshe was standing and serving everyone. So our sages say that this is the way of the rabbis. Many times there were meals where the rabbis stood and hosted. Avram Avinu would stand and host three Muslims. Three Arabs that came to his house. Why is he hosting them? Because no one views that as degradatory. There's nothing wrong with being the host. with serving people. So Moshe Rabbeinu is standing there and serving while everyone's eating. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with standing and serving your guests. It's a positive thing. So the big question here is, what's going on here? The next morning, Moshe's judging the people. They haven't yet received the Torah. So we have two opinions here. One opinion says that Hashem didn't give us the Torah when Moshe's own family wasn't there yet. This story happens the way it's written. Moshe's family came and then we received the Torah. The other opinion says, Yisro is recounting all the amazing things Hashem did, and he doesn't recount giving the Torah. So that certainly sounds like the Torah wasn't given yet, right? But the other opinion, I'm sorry, is the opinion that says that no, this whole story happened much later. It's recounted here. But Yisro came after the Torah was given. And that's why Moshe is sitting and judging the people this morning. The next morning is Yom Kippur. Moshe Rabbeinu is sitting there and judging the people. It's long after the Torah has been given. It's written out of order. Two opinions in the Midrash. So, yes. Moshe is sitting and all the people are coming and waiting in line to argue their case before him. Yisro says, what are you doing? People are standing here in line forever. That's not right. Moshe says, they all want to know what Hashem wants of them, and they also want me to pray on their sick, on behalf of their sick. You guys know that there's a halacha like that? If someone's ill, then it's recommended to go to the local rabbi and ask him to daven for the person. That's why we say Mishaberach, for the sick, in our shul. Why? Because this is the shul, this is the community, this is the center. So we want to pray on behalf of the person. At his rabbi should say the Mishaberach L'cholim. We're doing that. That's the idea. Yes?
It was Yom Kippur or the day after Yom Kippur?
The morning after Yom Kippur, yes. So Yisro comes and gives him advice. And here we see a recurring theme in Tanakh that Moshe, even though he's the leader, is willing to hear what other people say. He says, okay, I'll ask Hashem. That's your idea. La. As yes, od mekoma. There's a very nice vort, you guys, if you have to say Dvar Torah this Shabbos, so I'll give you now a very nice Dvar Torah. It says that Yisro was called Yeser, Rashi quotes in the beginning of the parasha. Why? Because he added a parasha to the Torah, right? You know Rashi? Yeser means to add, so Yisro is called Yeser because he added a parasha to the Torah. Rashi says, which parasha did he add? The parasha where he tells Moshe, you should choose the fine people to lead and judge the people and answer their questions. So the question is, why did Rashi quote from there? Yisro began by telling Moshe Rabbeinu, this isn't a good idea what you're doing here. You're going to wear out. The nation's going to wear out. This is too hard for you to do it alone. Listen here, I'll give you advice. Go choose the proper people. Why did Rashi skip three psukim and then quote the pasuk in which Yisro only says his third sentence, which is, choose proper people? Rashi should have said the first sentence where Yisro says, this is not a good idea. This isn't the way to do things. That's where Yisro begins talking. That's the parasha he added to the Torah. So they say, I don't know who says this, but it's a nice idea, that to come out and point what's wrong, for that Yisro wouldn't have gotten credit. To just be the guy who says, this isn't a good idea and you shouldn't do this way, anyone can do that. The brilliance of Yisro was that he came with a solution. And that's why when Rashi quotes that Yisro added a parasha to the Torah, so Rashi quotes that Yisro added the advice which he gave, which was to appoint judges, people who work under Moshe. When we speak about the judges, so Yisro gives many, many criteria for the judges. It says that Moshe did not find people with all those criteria, meaning he made the bar too high. And we set up judges. So now we have judges for the Jewish people. And we've come to Mount Sinai. Our sages say this is the only time that we camped in unity. Vayichan Sham Yisrael. The pasuk describes that we camped ki'ish echad b'lev echad, completely unified. It's interesting. First of all, that's a warning sign for all of us that we have this weakness, I guess, as a Jewish people, that we tend to be quarrelsome. Maybe we can see that in modern day Israel, that I think we have the highest per capita number of lawyers in any country in the world. I'm not sure that's something to be so proud of. The Torah doesn't seem to describe it as being something positive, that we're always fighting for our rights. So maybe that's something to think about whenever we're about to start a fight. Maybe we should think, maybe this is our weakness, not our strength, the fact that we can argue our case. We've come to Mount Sinai and we're going to be unified. Why is it called Mount Sinai? So, because it's in the Sinai Desert. Why is it called the Sinai Desert? Because it's got Mount Sinai in it. Okay, so why is it called Mount Sinai? No?
He said it's in Sinai.
Oh, no. Why is it called Har Sinai? What's the root of the word Sinai? What's the root of the word Sinai? Either Sne, the bush which Moshe Rabbeinu saw over there on that mountain, or it's synonymous with the word Sinah. Our sages say even though Sinah is not written like Sinai, it's the same idea, that when we became the chosen people on Mount Sinai, that's when the world started hating us. That's what Maimonides writes in the Yemenite Epistle in the Igaret Teiman. The world started hating us when we became the chosen people. It says that's when hatred came down to the world. That's why the world hates us. That's why there's anti-Semitism, because we took the Torah. So we've come to Mount Sinai. Now, what's the history of Mount Sinai? Moshe Rabbeinu is watching Jethro's sheep. He goes out to the desert. And then there's a sheep that runs away astray. And Moshe Rabbeinu runs after it. And he takes care of it. And he carries it on his shoulder. And he says, "You were thirsty, poor thing. I'm not going to let you go alone. I'll take care of you." And even though he just chased after the sheep, he puts it on his shoulder and carries it back. And then he sees a burning bush. What does he see in the burning bush? He sees a cactus with its thorns pointing downward so that you could easily stick your hand into the cactus, but if you try to pull out your hand gets all cut up. And he sees this cactus that's called a snare, and he sees it burning. And the flame is all around it, but it keeps burning. Never turns into coal and never stops burning. And he stops and he takes a look, and Hashem appears to him. And Hashem tells him, "I am Hashem. Here, you see this vision you've just seen?" Hashem first appears to him in the voice of his father, right? Moshe Rabbeinu hears his father. So he turns around and says, "Dad, where are you?" And then Hashem says, "No, I'm Hashem, the God of your father." Moshe Rabbeinu says, "Wow, my father made it. He's just like Avraham Avinu, Yitzchak, Yaakov, that Hashem calls himself the God of my father. My father Amram is such a tzaddik." So then Hashem says, "No, I'm the God of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. I just wanted you to know who I am. I didn't want to scare you. So I began with your father's voice." You see the burning bush, that's a sign for Israel. First of all, Hashem appears in the humbly low bush. Hashem doesn't look for the highest tree. Secondly, Hashem says, just like the fire is burning and the bush doesn't get destroyed, so too Israel is being afflicted by the Egyptians, but they will not be destroyed. And finally, just like it was easy to go into Egypt and it's so difficult to come out, so too that's like this bush, which it's easy to stick your hand into, but your hand gets all torn up if it comes out. And I am the fire around the bush. I will ultimately destroy Egypt, but I'm going to leave them around, just like the bush was around. I'm going to leave it around to punish them and to teach the world. And I want you to go and tell the Jewish people it's time to come out of Egypt. And Moshe says, "But until now in world history, you spoke to whoever you wanted to talk to. You never sent one person to say, 'God told me to tell you.' That's a new thing you're doing in the world. I don't want to be the one to do it." God says, "You're the one to do it." And Moshe says, "I'd rather not." And Hashem says, "But you should." And this goes back and forth for 7 days. It's going back and forth. Hashem tells him to go. And Moshe says, "No." And Moshe is thinking, my brother Aaron was the leader of the Jewish people. He was the prophet until now. So he says, "Hashem, send the guy you're used to sending. Send my brother Aaron." And Hashem tells Moshe, "You're worried Aaron's going to be jealous? Don't worry. I'm telling you that when he sees you as a leader, he's going to be happy." So Moshe says, "I don't want to go. I'm scared." Because Hashem says, "Here are the signs you could do." Moshe says, "Yeah, but but they won't believe me. Hashem says, here are the signs, they'll believe you. Moshe says, but I don't want to be a part of the religion if they're going to believe me because of signs. If the reason they're going to believe me is because I did a miracle or two or three, then I don't want that, because then down the road, they're going to look back and say, maybe he tricked us. I don't want to be the leader who's going to lead the Jewish people that way. Because then in hindsight, there's always room to wonder. Maybe he tricked us. So Hashem says, okay, I'm telling you, you're going to come back to this mountain, and I'm going to give them prophetic revelation. And every one of them is going to see the prophecy. And when they see it and they recognize that I am talking to them, an experience that no other nation in the world ever had, so then it's going to be crystal clear for eternity. No one will doubt your prophecy. The Jewish people will remain faithful to you, Moshe. They're never going to doubt it again. Moshe says, okay, if you're going to do that, that's why we're coming back to Sinai. It's a fulfillment of that prophecy that Hashem said that they're going to come to this mountain and I will reveal myself to them. That's what Moshe wanted. That every individual would see that Hashem had given us the Torah. So that there wouldn't be this area of doubt. Yismach Moshe b'matnat chilko ki eved ne'eman lo ani mitzter slicha i'vshach kol hazman likanes tomar lehem vakasha i'vshach eved ne'eman karata lo. Moshe Rabbeinu is called the trusted servant. You guys will forgive me, but they have chairs in the whole machon. If they don't understand of their own accord that it's disrespectful to everyone here, not just to me, to walk into a class and stop the whole class to take chairs, then I'll tell them that. It's not right. They have the whole machon to take chairs from.
Second issue with the two.
What?
The second issue with the two.
I'm not...
The second issue. They pulled all these other chairs in here and they left them here. They never cleaned up after themselves.
Say that. That's, I'm saying, that's another question. But I ordinarily, you know, they want to take a chair, let them take a chair. But if they're going to keep coming in here, that's not right. So Hashem is taking us back to Mount Sinai. We said that goes back to the word sneh. That goes back to the bush. That Moshe Rabbeinu saw the burning bush on this mountain, and Hashem promised him they'd come back to this mountain, and now they're coming to the mountain. So Moshe ascends the mountain. The Talmud in Tractate Sukkah says that Moshe Rabbeinu did not go to heaven. Okay? Just you should know. Talmud says Moshe was at the top of the mountain, and the Talmud says Hashem did not descend onto the mountain. Hashem descended and was hovering above the mountain. It says mankind does not go above earth. Man stays on earth. Moshe was at the top of the mountain. There's a miraculous thing that happened that he was there for 40 days and 40 nights. I know you guys are accustomed to the other Midrash, and Moshe went up to heaven, etc. Okay, fine. So I'm just saying, you should know that there is a Talmud in Tractate, in the beginning of Tractate Sukkah, that says that no, Moshe Rabbeinu did not go up, and Hashem, when he came down, stayed above 10 Tfachim. Hashem's presence does not go down beneath that. The 10 hand widths off earth is man's domain, and up above that is Hashem's domain. So Hashem leaves that for mankind. Hashem says to the Jewish people, I've brought you here on the wings of eagles. Okay, did you hear that? Hashem describes that he brought us to Sinai on the wings of eagles, right?
There was like some rabbis in the States who actually said like it's okay to travel into outer space, like as an astronaut.
Okay.
So you just said like this is the domain of man, this is the domain of the national mind. So how can these rabbis say as a verdict like it's okay to be an astronaut and travel into outer space?
You're asking a very good question. Let's ask a different question. How are we allowed to board a plane? I remember, I heard of people that when they first started air travel, they said, man was made to go on land. Man was not made to go in heaven, right? You're not supposed to board a plane, but obviously we do board planes, right? In truth, you're forcing me back to the Gemara in Sukkah, and many commentaries on that Gemara discuss that Gemara shouldn't be understood so simply. Meaning, I'm saying it simply, ten tfachim. The reason I'm saying it simply is because the Gemara actually derives halachot of the height of ten tfachim for our Sukkah, of the way we have to set up a minimum size of a wall. So the Gemara certainly seems to be talking factually, practically, on the earth. But definitely there are commentaries that say, like you, that we do go to heaven if necessary and if possible. If we can fly, we fly. And we don't say, hey, that's Hashem's domain, we shouldn't be up there. So then the question is, so what did the Gemara mean by that? So there are for sure midrashim that say that Moshe went to heaven. But it's important you should know this Gemara too. So I agree with you. I did not address the question. I just said that the question is addressed. Coming back to the wings of eagles. So this terminology, I carried you on the wings of eagles, obviously is metaphoric. Doesn't mean literally. And then the question is, what's the stress? Well, on the wings of eagles means Hashem protected us and took us out comfortably. Is that the idea? I mention this because people, we have a street up the block called Kanfei Nesharim, the wings of eagles. People wanted to say that when they brought the Yemenite Jews on airplanes, so many of the Yemenite Jews never saw an airplane until they came to Israel. So the people coming to take them out of Yemen, bringing them to Israel, said, these are the eagles. You remember the prophecy? Hashem will bring you on eagle's wings. These are the eagles. The Yemenites would sit on the floor. They didn't know they were supposed to sit on the chairs there. They tried to make fires in the plane, to eat up their food. They tried to make little fires. They had no idea. They never saw such a thing. And they were sure Mashiach had come. When they saw airplanes, they were sure the Mashiach had come. That's why they were able to take all their wealth. That's why so many people were able to steal from them, because they were gullible. They were convinced this is the Messiah. These are the wings of eagles. So here we see in our parsha that the wings of eagles doesn't have to mean an airplane. Wings of eagles can mean some form of comfortable way in which Hashem takes us and protects us. Just like an eagle carries its young on its wing or on its back. We have a job here. The Torah describes it as, we are going to be Mamlechet Kohanim. Oh, we have a Kohen here. I shouldn't say this in front of him. So we have to be a kingdom of Kohanim. What is a Kohen in Hebrew?
A priest.
A Kohen is a noble. We're supposed to be a kingdom of nobles. We're supposed to be leaders. Our sages say that the Jewish people are like oil. Every exile you put them in, just like you pour water on oil, somehow they end up on top. They always work their way to the top. They're like oil. They have a hard time staying down. We are Mamlechet Kohanim. That's a plus, but it's also a difficult trait, because that's one of our hardships here in the state of Israel, that there aren't that many Jews that want to work as builders. There aren't that many Jews that want to work as garbage men. There are a lot of tasks that people don't want to work. Every person feels like he has to do more. So it's a strength, but it's also something to think about.
It's also our commandment to be humble.
Humble with self-worth, yeah.
Yeah.
So Moshe brings them the Torah, and what do the Jews say? We'll do whatever Hashem says. So this is a unique level, because remember, Hashem sent prophets to many nations with the Torah. That's why if you find the code of Hammurabi, or you find other things that seem similar to the Torah, it shouldn't bother you, because our tradition for thousands of years is that before Hashem offered us the Torah, Hashem sent prophets to other nations and offered them a similar thing, some form of Torah. So then finally Hashem comes to us. What's the difference between the nations and us? So the difference can be understood with the following story. There was once a town that wanted to put in a Sefer Torah. So they hired a scribe, and the scribe was working diligently writing the Sefer Torah. And they reached the point where it was going to be 4 months away, they were going to bring in the Sefer Torah. So they needed one of the women of the community to make a jacket to put on the Sefer Torah. So they decided, they asked how many women want to do it, and every woman in town wanted to be the one to make the jacket for the Torah everyone's been waiting for. So they said, fine, you have 1 month to prepare it, and at the end of the month, we will make a contest, we have a panel, they will choose the nicest jacket, and that's the jacket we'll put on the Sefer Torah. And on the day that we bring in the Sefer Torah, we'll have this big party and everyone will come and we'll have a parade. And you can invite your relatives, and that woman's jacket will be on it when we bring it into the shul. And the other ones will be spare. We'll save them. As it wears down, we'll use the other ones. Fine, so every woman works diligently in the name of honoring Hashem. They're going to make a nice jacket for the Torah scroll. And the month ends, and every woman brings her jacket, and they set them out, and the panel goes through all the jackets, and they take a vote, and they agree that there's one jacket that's the chosen jacket, it's the nicest jacket for the Torah. So they put the other ones in storage, the other ones are going to be as backups, and they take her jacket, and they leave it in shul, ready for the final day. Now this woman, in the honor of Torah, honoring her creator, she sends letters to every relative she ever met or didn't meet, anyone under the sun who might want to come to see the great honor of the Torah. She writes them an excited letter. Come honor the Torah. On this day, I was chosen that it's my jacket that will be honoring the Torah. But come in honor of the Torah and join us in the celebration of putting in the new Sefer Torah. She invites her parents, her uncles, her aunts, her nephews, her nieces, every person she could think of. Everyone should come and honor the Torah, right? Okay? The day comes. And relatives start piling in to the train station, and the scribe is sitting in the room writing the final letters of the Sefer Torah. Leinei Kol Yisrael, he writes the final Lamed, and they say, okay, let's wait for it to dry. It dries. They ask for the jacket. They bring in the jacket, and she is standing outside, and she's just bubbling with joy, in honor of the Torah, of course, that now everyone's come to honor the Torah, and they ask her to bring in the jacket. She brings in the jacket. She tries to be modest about it. As she brings in the jacket, they roll up the Torah and they put the jacket on. And the jacket is 4 inches short. Doesn't reach the bottom. They try again. Doesn't reach the bottom. They say, lady, we're sorry, but you must have made a mistake in your measurements. She says, can't be. She grabs the jacket. She tries to pull it harder. And no, they're right. She made the jacket too short. So they're standing there, and then they say, you know, we'll take the next one. We pick. If you guys could put your phones on silent, that would be appreciated. We picked the first. We also picked the second, so we'll take the second. So the woman grabs it, and she says, wait, you can't do that. All her relatives, all her family's out there, and she's been describing the jacket for months, telling everyone what it's like, and now they're going to take out a different jacket? In honor of Torah, she says, look, I saw the way the scribe worked. She says to the scribe, I saw the way you worked, and I saw how you cut everything to be exactly the same size. I'll tell you what you can do. It'll take 5 minutes, but you can make it happen. You take your knife, and you cut the bottom of the Torah. You just cut off the bottom of the parchment, and the parchment will be that much shorter, and then my... Okay, so that's the story in a nutshell. Why is this story so important? Because here the woman was telling everyone, come in honor of the Torah, come give honor to Hashem, come give honor to the Torah. Who is she really looking to honor? She was interested in her own honor. And in truth, we all have that weakness, where we like to say it's in the honor of Hashem, but really, the question is, are we willing to cut that Torah to fit our jacket? And when Hashem brought the Torah to the nations, what did the nations say? What's written in it? What was the meaning of asking that question? The meaning was, I am going to decide what God should say and what God shouldn't say. If it makes sense to me, I'll accept it. And if it doesn't make sense to me, so then leave it. Wait a second, are we here to hear? Did we come to hear what Hashem has to say? Or did we come to tell Hashem what to tell us? If I'm going to define what the Torah can tell me, so then it's a man-made religion. Man is going to put the limits. You can tell me, but only so much. Comes Am Yisrael and says, whatever Hashem says, we will do. But you don't know what He's going to tell you. What's the intelligence in that? How do you sign an open check? You have no idea. And if Hashem told you to jump off a roof? But they were saying, He's the boss. There's no point in my putting limitations. I have no idea what's right or wrong. He created the world. That was the greatness in that comment. Later on, they're going to say, Na'aseh v'nishma. What do the words Na'aseh v'nishma mean? That is almost correct. Na'aseh, we will do, v'nishma, and we will obey whatever Hashem says. Nishma, also Rashi translates in the book of Bereishis, that nishma means we will obey. Whatever He says, we're ready to do. So Hashem says, I'm going to come, and Moshe is going to spend 6 days in the cloud. The people are going to see Him in the fog, standing there for 6 days. For 6 days, His body has to be cleansed of all waste. And Moshe Rabbeinu is going to tremble and shake and be prepared for the great revelation of Sinai. So, Moshe goes to the people and tells them, you have to prepare yourself, you have to purify yourself. They are about to undergo the first gear process in the world. The first gear process is Am Yisrael, as a people, are converting. From there we learn the laws of Giyur. So the Jewish people are going to go to mikveh now, purify themselves. They're going to put their clothing in mikveh. They're going to separate from their wives 3 days. Why do they have to separate from their wives 3 days? Who knows?
Purify.
Okay, so we have the following concept in halacha. When a man emits his seed, he becomes tamei, becomes spiritually defiled, until he goes to mikveh and nightfall comes.
When a man
emits his seed, yes.
Yeah.
So when a woman has the man's seed inside her, so then when that seed comes out, so then she becomes defiled.
Yeah.
And our sages said that the seed will last. It can procreate for 3 days. Interesting that modern science came to the same conclusion. Up until this century, no one knew this. But the Torah, Moshe tells the people, separate for your wives for 3 days. Why 3 days? Because if a man is intimate with his wife, and some of that seed comes out after 2 days, then she will be defiled, and she won't accept the Torah in purity. So you see here, again, the same concept. That care, that concern, that the women get the Torah in purity too. Not only the men. So they take 3 days off. Men and women separate from one another in the homes. They're not going to be intimate so that the women can also be pure. So the women go to mikveh and the men go to mikveh. How do you go to mikveh, by the way? When you go to mikveh, what's a mikveh? A mikveh is a body of water that has 40 sa'ah, that the average human being can be enveloped by the water. And that water is water that was never in a vessel. It's water, it's rainwater that's pure, that never was held in any vessel. We set up ramps and we set up ways for all that water, to, the rain, to end up in that pit, but that's a mikveh. And when a person goes to mikveh, so they cannot have any separation on their body. Their full body has to be in the mikveh, so they can't have any dirt under their nails. They can't have any scabs. There's even a custom that when a person immerses for giyur, they take a close haircut, or in ancient times they used to shave all their hair, but they want their full body in. When a woman goes to mikveh, she takes an hour and a half preparing. She combs her hair to make sure there's nothing stuck in her hair. She goes through everything. She checks everything. She checks the corners of her eyes. There shouldn't be any dirt over there. She blows her nose. She cleans out her ears. She cleans every part of her body to make sure the whole body is in the mikveh. So us men, when we go to mikveh, we don't have to be so careful. We're not biblically obligated to go to mikveh. But they were. So they had all these preparations and they go to mikveh. And no one's allowed to touch the mountain now.
You say we're not biblically obligated.
Men are not biblically obligated to go to mikveh.
We have like when a sperm comes out.
There's no biblical obligation today for a man to go to the mikveh. The only time a man might need to go to a mikveh and fulfill that mitzvah biblically is when a man is undergoing giyur, or when a woman goes to mikveh. Those who hold that it's permissible to go up on the Temple Mount have to learn the halachot really well about how to go to mikveh and which mikveh is okay for them to go to. Not all mikvot are okay for a man to toivel for going up to the Temple Mount. I said that when a man emits his seed, so then a man today, when we do not have a temple, a man does not have to go to mikveh biblically. Correct.
When the temple is back, we have to take a mikveh after you.
No, when the temple is built, so then in honor of the holidays, every person has to purify himself. And in order to bring sacrifices, every person has to purify himself. But on a day-to-day basis, if a person chooses not to, he doesn't have to.
Like if you are intimate with your wife, you don't have to take a mikveh 3 days after. You just
correct. Okay, the nation oversleeps. Comes the morning of receiving the Torah, they've slept late. And Moshe comes out and he's calling everyone, guys, come out, you're saying it's a segula. That's what we're doing today. Okay. Ma'asevot siman lebanim. Okay, so in order to ensure we don't say that, we have the custom on Shavuos night, when we're commemorating the receiving of the Torah, the Ten Commandments. So we stay up all night. We say, we messed up once, we're not doing it again. So we stay up all night, we say, Hashem, you're going to see, this time we're going to be okay. Moshe goes to call everyone to Mount Sinai. Now the people were prepared to receive the written law. But then, the people here, Hashem's going to give you an oral law too. And how are you going to learn the oral law? From rabbis. So the people say, we don't want that. We don't want to learn Torah from rabbis. We're willing to take the written law, whatever Hashem says. We said we're willing to accept whatever Hashem says. But the oral law, we want a connection with Hashem directly. Let me learn Torah, let me interpret it. Why is the rabbi going to tell me how to interpret Torah? I don't want that. Every Jew has an internal desire to connect Hashem directly. No Jew wants a rabbi to tell him what to do. We have built in, notice, you come to a lecture hall. The professor is going to give you a lecture on thermodynamics. No one starts arguing with him. You come to a lecture hall, the lecturer is going to give a lecture on quantum physics. No one's arguing with him. You come to a lecture hall, and the chief rabbi is going to give a lecture on medicine and ethics, and suddenly everyone has an opinion on what the Torah's ethics should be. Wait, did you ever study? Rabbi Lau was chief rabbi, and he came to a conference, and all the professors were heated. They were ready to argue with him about Torah ethics. So he said, before we start the conference, I want to ask one question. So they said, fine. He said, who can tell me what's written in a mezuzah? So they all sat silent. And finally, one doctor raised his hand and said, Tfilat HaDerech. So no one knew. Okay, they didn't know the most basic thing in Judaism, that Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, is what's written in the mezuzah, obviously with the parsha of Vayom Shamoah. So he said, you guys don't know what's written in the mezuzah. You want to argue with me about what the Torah has to say about medical ethics? Why is that? Why is it that when it comes to Torah, everyone has an opinion? Because Hashem created us that we all have an internal compass, we have an internal connection to the Torah. And every person feels like I have a hand in that. I understand that. I want to understand that. I don't want an intermediary. I don't want anyone else telling me Torah. The Talmud says, based on the verse in Psalms, a scary thing. It says, "Vaykanu l'Moshe b'machaneh." The verse in Psalms says that we know there's a law of sota, right? A man can tell his wife, I don't want you to be alone with that guy. Be extra careful. Don't be alone with him, right? And if she's alone with him again, then he could do the whole sota procedure with her, right? So it says that every Jew in Israel told his wife, be careful from that guy Moshe. It says every Jew told his wife, I don't want you to be alone with him. Moshe, the holiest of men, Moshe Rabbeinu, you're talking about a man who starts his career at 80 years old. He's not a young man. And we know that he separated from his whole own wife. That's what they were worried about. So the answer is, every man felt threatened in their own home. Why did they have to say that? Because in a person's own home, a person wants to feel like, I call the shots. I know the Torah. I can impart spirituality into my own home, because everyone wants to feel connected to the Torah. Now they had a situation that was hard for them. Suddenly a person feels like, Moshe has to tell me what to do. Any question that comes up, the husband says, let me ask Moshe. Let me check. Moshe taught us to do it this way. No one feels good. I want to be connected to Hashem. I want to be the connector for my house with the word of Hashem. So when that happened, every person felt the need to tell his wife, I want you to stay away from Moshe. So we come to the receipt of the Torah, and the Jewish people are willing to accept the written Torah. They say, God, whatever you have to say, we're willing to do. Then Hashem tells them there's going to be an oral law, and the oral law is hard. And it's like walking through a dark forest. You have a difficult time finding your way in the oral Torah. The written Torah is pleasant. It's like daytime. You read it, you understand more, you understand less, but it's pleasant. You come to the oral tradition, that's so hard. You got to learn for years, and it's hard learning. So the Jewish people say, we don't want that. And that's why the Torah describes Am Yisrael stood under the mountain. Our sages say Hashem had to lift Mount Sinai and hold it over the Jewish people and say, either you accept the Torah with the oral law, or you're going to be buried right there. So at the revelation at Sinai, Mount Sinai was lifted. And the Jewish people were asked, now do you want to accept this? So they said yes. So that's, the Jewish people accepted willingly the written Torah, but they accepted forcibly the oral Torah. The oral Torah they really didn't want. But that's why the Torah says, "B'tachtit ahar," Hashem held the mountain over their heads like an upside down basin. So Hashem appears on Sinai, and Moshe comes up the mountain, and Hashem tells Moshe, "I want you to go down and warn the nation not to come up, because when they see a revelation, they might be attracted and run towards it." So Moshe says, Moshe doesn't want to go down. Moshe wants to be on top of the mountain, on that higher level of spirituality, at the moment when Hashem gives the Ten Commandments. And Hashem tells Moshe to go down, and Moshe asks to stay up. So Hashem says, okay, Moshe, just go tell them not to come up the mountain. So Moshe is concerned that when he's down there, Hashem will start the Ten Commandments without him. So Moshe says, but the nation already knows that they're not allowed to come up, and they're not going to come up. So Hashem says, yeah, but go and warn them again. So Moshe goes down, and as he's talking to them, that's exactly what happens. The Ten Commandments begin. Now you can understand, Hashem gently had Moshe descend from the mountain, even though Moshe didn't want it, but it was important also, so that the Jewish people are very clear that Moshe is not the one with a loudspeaker up there talking. It had to be very clear that Moshe was down with them when Hashem gave the Ten Commandments. Hashem appears, and the people start having prophetic vision, and the people can't handle it. And so the first two commandments are said in the first person. Hashem says, I am Hashem, your God. I took you out of Egypt. Introductory. Is that a mitzvah? Rambam says it is. Others question that. They say, that's the precept for all mitzvahs. You have that. You have commandments. You don't have that. You don't have commandments. How could that be a mitzvah? Ah, because I can connect to the concept or I cannot connect to the concept. I could walk around and ignore that concept. Or I can connect it. It's not too hard to connect to. But any time that a person thinks to himself, Hashem runs the world, he took us out of Egypt, he's the creator and he's the one who took us out of Egypt, he controls the world, he's fulfilled this mitzvah. The question is, will we think about it? Obviously, we can develop our understanding of that mitzvah. You may not believe in forces other than Hashem, other than me, Hashem says. So the first two commandments we heard directly from Hashem. Let's learn Torah. Okay. The Torah says we're not allowed to make figures of what's in heaven. People don't know this. We're not supposed to draw pictures of the sun and the moon, etc. We're not supposed to draw figures of that. Hashem says, I carry over the wanton sins of fathers to future generations. Even if, notice the difference. Here we're talking about avon, when a person transgresses on purpose. So then his children and grandchildren can be held accountable. Where Hashem says that when a person makes a mistake, Hashem won't pass that on to future generations. Yes?
You cannot make an image of something under the heaven and above the heaven. And that way I still didn't hang up one of these things in my house. But you see a lot of pictures of rabbis, and drawings of rabbis, and we hang it up in our study halls and in our places. But we're not allowed to make pictures. What's the whole deal about? Why is it allowed? Can you explain that to me? It's a question I've had for a long time.
There were really two opinions of whether this is included in the prohibition, whether it's permitted or prohibited. And like Rav Kook writes in one of his responsa, that we see today what's been accepted is that it's permitted, and that's what we go with. We go with the opinion that it is permissible to have photographs and pictures of people. Yes, that's permissible.
Like a drawing of a rabbi. It is
right. That is, you're right. So that's permissible. When you learn the sugya, we can discuss the details. But in general, yes. Hashem says, I took you out of Egypt. So Hashem is pointing out, I'm watching over the world. One of the messages we get from Hashem taking us out of Egypt is that there's hashkacha. You see, I paid attention. I punished them. I took care of you. You also see that Hashem has capacity to affect the world. It's not just that he created it and left it to run. Hashem says, I repay those that love me. Those that love Hashem are those that are willing to be dedicated and not be pagans and not be led astray. We are commanded not to take Hashem's name in vain. What's called taking Hashem's name in vain? That's a person that swears about something that's obvious. I swear it's nighttime now. That's a vow that's prohibited. Our sages say that the heavens and earth shake when a person takes a vow in vain. And so when a person would have to take a vow in court, they would take him and warn him and say, we want you to know that it's very severe, that the heavens and earth, there's a covenant between us and Hashem, that we won't, between Hashem and us, that we won't take Hashem's name in vain, and terrible things come to the world if people swear in vain. Now you have to know that this is also if you say it in English, even if you say it in another language. It doesn't matter. A person is not allowed to swear in vain. You're not allowed to swear falsely. You're not allowed to swear in vain. Swearing in vain is also about something that's obviously incorrect. A person says, I swear it's day right now. Everyone knows it's night. So he's taken a vow. I swear yesterday the Super Bowl was 10 hours long. You know it wasn't. So a person swears about something that's obviously not. Now, what's unique about the Ten Commandments? So Rav Saadia Gaon held that the Ten Commandments are all-encompassing. That within the commandments, if you understand well what's going on in the Ten Commandments, they are encompassing of all 613. And so Rav Saadia Gaon wrote a poetic work which shows how each of the 613 are within each one of the commandments. There used to be a custom that on Shavuos morning, when they'd read the Ten Commandments, they would read Rav Saadia Gaon's song within the commandments. You guys do that?
Okay. I think we read another version, but we do read this.
Okay. The Medrash says we had five commandments on each of the two tablets. Now that's strange, because if you look closely, the first five have many, many, many more words than the second five. The first five are focused on the honor of Hashem. The second five are focused on the honor of man. It says that when Hashem gave the commandments, the whole world could hear it. So the world heard the first commandment. I am Hashem, your God. They said, great, every religion says that. You should have no God but me. Every religion says that. Don't swear my name in vain. Every religion says that. They heard the first five. They weren't impressed. Then they heard Hashem says, honor your father and mother. They said, no other religion does that. No religion tells you how you have to behave to someone else. Every religion before Torah was always focused on honoring the gods, deal with the gods, help the gods. None of them dealt with the idea of our morality, how we behave. Don't steal, don't covet. This idea, the nations heard it and they said, this is an amazing religion. You see, other religions were always focused on honoring the gods. So they figured, okay, here Hashem is only worried about honoring himself. Then they saw, no, that's not true. Hashem is focused on us leading correct lives. Now, the Mabit was a contemporary of Rav Yosef Karo, and he writes the following. He says, if each tablet had five commandments, that means that the second tablet, which had the commandments between man and his friend, had very few words compared to the first tablet, right? Lo tirtzach, don't murder. Okay, two words. Compare that with Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Otziticha Meretz Mitzrayim Mibeit Avadim. That's many few, less words. So the Mabit says, right, the second tablet had the wording in a larger font. The commandments between man and his friend were written in a larger font. Yes, we can respect Hashem, we can honor Hashem, we can do all that. Can we really not desire our friend's car, our friend's house? So, we have the Ten Commandments. Rav Saadia Gaon says they are an encapsulation of all of the Torah. Ramban says differently. Ramban says, what does a person have to know before they convert to Judaism? They don't have to know the whole Torah. We said this is a miniature conversion process, right? Miniature. This is the first conversion process. So just like a person before he converts learns parts of the Torah, miktsat mitzvot kelot, umiktsat mitzvot chamurot, some of the severe commandments, some of the lighter commandments, and then they decide, is this for me? That's what the Ten Commandments are. Nachmanides says the Ten Commandments are a sampling of the Torah. Some of the lighter commandments, some of the heavier commandments. In these commandments, we know it says, zachor et yom ha-shabbat lekadsho. Remember the day of Shabbos. How do we remember the day of Shabbos? So number one, Nachmanides says, that's the biblical mitzvah every day. We say, Hayom Yom Sheni B'Shabbat. That's why you should try to say, even if you don't say the full thing, just say that sentence. Hayom Yom Sheni B'Shabbat. Yom Yom Shlishi B'Shabbat. You say what day of the week it is. Secondly, if you have something delicious, you got a special treat, you got a special sweet, you save it for Shabbos. So that's you remember Shabbos all week long. The mitzvah of Zochar Yom HaShabbos is that Hashem says, I created the world in 6 days, I rested on the seventh. So too, I want you to have one day which you make special. So we have special bread. We eat challah on Shabbos. We sleep a little later on Shabbos. We wear special clothing. We do things to honor Shabbos and to pleasure Shabbos. And you guys have to connect to that. I say that because people don't always have a special clothing for Shabbos. So get. I brought you guys some stuff for free. Those who still need, there are secondhand stores. It's not so expensive. For a shekel or two, you can buy a nice white shirt. You could buy a nice jacket, a nice pair of pants. You should have nice clothing for Shabbos. It's not expensive. But that's part of how we remember Shabbos. How else do we remember Shabbos? We make Kiddush and Havdalah. Before I make Kiddush, I try to remind my family, what are we doing now? The kids already know. We're doing the biblical commandment and the Ten Commandments, Zachot, Yom Shabbat, Nekadsho. That's what we're doing now. We're told, Lo Tachmod. Lo Tachmod. So Rabbi Yoshua ibn Shuib was a disciple of the Rashba, who was a disciple of Nachmanides. And he says that is the most severe of the commandments. All prohibitions are encompassed by that. Lo tachmod, don't desire. It all starts there. And I always find this to be such a great commandment. It's one of my favorite because it reorients us. The other commandments tell us how to behave. This commandment, every time I reach it reminds me how Hashem touches us and tells us, you can control your thoughts, you can control your desires, you are not a slave to your desires. You know, people use the sentence, he upset me, it got on my nerves. No, I chose to be upset. When people ask me if I'm upset, why I'm upset, if they're close enough to me, then I'll tell them I'm upset because I haven't worked on myself enough yet. That's the real answer why I'm upset. It could be someone else did something upsetting, but I haven't yet perfected my trait, so I've gotten upset. So we have a commandment that's so important. Don't desire what your friend has. You can desire to move forward in the world. You can't look at your friend's house and say, I wish I had that. I wish I had his car. So here we have a very interesting Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra says, how does the Torah tell us what to desire and what not to desire? How does that work? So the Ibn Ezra says, we desire that which we think we can get. The Talmud says, how come you had situations where when the death penalty was administered, some men could be in the room when a woman was executed? How did you do that? Weren't you worried the men would end up having improper thoughts about that woman later? It's not the most modest thing when a person is executed. So the Talmud says an interesting concept. We can connect it to the Ibn Ezra. It says, no one dreams about something about a person who's dead. Well, according to the Ibn Ezra, we understand. The reason people don't fantasize about someone who's dead is because they know they're never going to get it. They know that that's inaccessible. So the Ibn Ezra says that the root of lo sachmod is decide that if the Torah said no, it's not happening. The reason a person has fantasies is because somewhere in their mind, the person's imagining, I'm going to get that still. But the Torah said no. So lo tachmod, according to the Ibn Ezra, is that we have to knock it into ourselves, I will not get that, I'm not going to have that, so then I don't have to desire it. If I know I'm not going to have it, I don't spend time desiring it. We desire it because somewhere in our imagination we think I can still get it. Yes?
What about the idea, I know it's not like 100% the same, but I know, like, for example, Chabad has an idea like Le'achila D'Arriba or something.
The what?
Le'achila, like, the Rebbe used to say, like, there's a mountain in front of you, don't try to go around it, you should, from the beginning, try to go over it. Right?
I don't know.
Okay, well,
I don't know about that. The Talmud says, Torah tzivalanu Moshe, the numerical value of Torah is 611. Moshe taught us 611 mitzvot. The other two we heard from Hashem. Anochi Hashem lokecha en lo yeyelecha, right? Those two we heard from Hashem. So, the Jewish people hear two of the commandments and they tell Moshe, we can't do this anymore. We're not. According to one Medrash, they died. According to one Medrash, they were resurrected. The Jewish people actually died. According to another Medrash, they leaped backwards a huge distance and angels came and pushed them forward. They couldn't handle the prophetic vision. So Moshe tells them, Hashem had you do this. Hear the commandments. We went through all the commandments more or less, right? Yes. Okay. Prohibition against kidnapping, giving false testimony. I want to tell you a joke because it has an important message. They say as a joke that if the Ten Commandments were a custom, then people would be more careful with them because people are so careful with customs. You know, if that's my custom, I have to do it. Well, what about the Ten Commandments? So So Moshe tells them, you had to hear it because you became a greater nation once you all heard prophetic vision. Nachmanides says that by hearing Hashem directly, so then from that moment onward, our spiritual DNA changed. And from that moment onward, it became much easier for us to be the people of the faith. It became a part of us. And Maimonides says that once we saw the prophetic vision, so then no one could test us after that. If any prophet comes and says, God told me a new religion is coming from heaven, we say, come on, 2 million people saw it from heaven. You replicate that, we're willing to hear what you have to say. You're not going to replicate that, we're not willing to hear what you have to say. So that's the idea of having this prophetic vision for everyone. We have a commandment at the end of the parasha. If we build an altar of stone, we have to be careful not to use metal on it. We shouldn't cut it with metal. That would desecrate it. So the standard understanding is that metal is used to shorten people's life and the altar is used to lengthen people's life. Maimonides says that it used to be a custom that they'd build pagan temples and pagan altars out of finely cut stones. And Hashem said, for me, I don't need that. I don't want you to be like the pagans. Use something modest and simple. You could use a simple natural stone. You could use earth. I don't want the fancy stone that they use in these temples. For me, simple is good. But don't use any metal to cut it finely. And the Torah warns not to reveal ourselves because part of the sacrifice, part of the rituals they would do in the pagan cults was that they would reveal themselves. They would actually reveal themselves as part of the worship, as we know in Baal Peor. What?
You mean like getting nude or something?
To some degree. We know that in Baal Peor, the way they'd serve it is they'd reveal themselves and go to the bathroom in front of it. That was part of the service of Baal Peor. So they wanted people to do something that they're naturally revolted by.
And then in Shulchan Aruch, in the beginning, you see like a lot of back dressed modestly, cover everything. And, yeah.
Right. And that's why the Torah also stresses the commandment that even the priests, even the Kohanim, have to wear an added layer. Ordinarily, people would only wear robes. The Kohanim have to wear an undergarment to cover their modesty, because the Torah is stressing, we are not going the way of the pagans. Hashem says, I want you to be modest people, and in my service you have to be even more modest. Okay, so that's our parsha in a nutshell.